This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, March 6, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, The Problem with God. They say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but a good title will get you to open a book and at least look inside. Paisley Rechdahl is a poet with five intriguingly titled books, which also give us glimpses into her preoccupations and her humor. One of them is called Six Girls Without Pants. Then there's a book of essays called The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee, Observations on Not Fitting In. Her latest book of poems is Animal Eye. Paisley Rechdahl joins me from the University of Utah, where she teaches. Paisley, we're going to hear you read your poem, Dear Lacuna, Dear Lard, but first we're going to take a little detour through a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who your poem is in many ways responding to. And specifically, we're going to hear Hopkins' poem, Carrion Comfort. Can you tell us a little bit about this poem before you read it?
Yes, this is one of his terrible sonnets in which he's asking himself and also God, essentially, some of the hardest questions that anyone can ask, which is, how do we live with despair? How do we continue on? How do we not end it for ourselves when we reach the darkest moments of our lives? And Carrion Comfort is exactly as the title suggests. It's obsessed and terrified with the carrion of his own flesh, his body, the mortality that he is wrestling to understand. And then also, how does God help us even potentially in our darkest moments?
Now, the poem seems to reference Carrion Crow, which is a famous folk song. It's sung in Ireland and England and in this country as well. But a carrion crow is an English crow, which is seen as a menacing animal. So go ahead and read the poem for us, if you would.
Carrion Comfort. Not. I'll not, carrion comfort, despair, not feast on thee, not untwist, slack they may be, these last strands of man in me, or, most weary, cry, I can no more. I can. Can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be. But thou terrible, why wouldst thou rude on me thy ring-world right foot rock? Lay a lion limb against me, scan with darksome, devouring eyes my bruised bones, and fan, in turns of tempest, me heaped there, me frantic to avoid thee and flee. Why? That my chaff might fly, my grain lie sheer and clear. Nay, in all that toil, that coil, since seems I kissed the rod, hand rather, my heart low, lapsed strength, stole joy, would laugh, cheer. Cheer whom, though? The hero whose heaven handling flung me, foot trod me? Or me that fought him? Oh, which one? Is it each one? That night, that year of now done darkness, I wretch lay wrestling with, my God, my God.
Yeah, that was Hopkins's Carrion Comfort. So in that last line, it suggests that he's chronicling an experience that's in the past. Of now done darkness, I wretch lay wrestling with, my God, my God. Mm-hmm. So it's an episode that he has recovered from enough at least to write this poem.
Right. And I think that last line is so interesting because it references, I think, two other moments in the Bible. I mean, obviously, there's the Jacob wrestling with the angel moment there.
Right.
But then also, I think that cry, my God, is also Jesus's cry from the cross. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
And so even though there's a sense of resolution in the poem in the sense that it's in the past tense, that sense of spiritual ongoing crisis, you know, why have you forsaken me, is still echoed in those last two lines, those last two moments, my God, my God.
And that's cramming quite a lot into one or two lines.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of Hopkins for me. The complexity works on every single level. Like every line could have two or three different sort of allusions to different moments in the Bible. It could have a tremendous amount of syntactical complexity, as you hear very clearly, the rhymes, the assonance, the consonants, and of course the alliteration. All of these things work together to create a poem that, even as it tries to come to a conclusion, will often sort of backtrack syntactically, argue against itself through its imagery, or just drown you in a kind of music.
Mm. I love how in this poem he can change his mind right in the middle of a sentence. And this is a sonnet. There's not much room to move him, but he can do something like, I can no more. And then the next sentence he says, I can. And then he says, can something, hope. Mm-hmm. It gives the impression of somebody thinking it out as he's moving through this crisis.
Yeah. And that tortured syntax, those two lines, I can no more, I can something, hope, wish day come, not choose, not to be. You know, you have to really parse out those double knots to sort of figure out, I'm going to stay alive.
Yeah, he's saying, I can't kill myself right there. And then to refer to God as, O thou terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the fear of God, but this is taking it to another degree to call God the terrible one.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, it's easier for somebody who, you know, is not like Hopkins, not somebody who devoted their life to worshiping God, essentially, to sort of see when you read the Bible the terribleness that God can represent. But I think that that's one of Hopkins' amazing moments here, too, which is he acknowledges that this divine beauty, you know, often does come off as terrible and potentially malicious and cruel if you read all of the biblical stories. And terrible, I think, is a word that carries so many connotations and denotations. I mean, we think of terrible as just terrible. It's just bad. But it is also awesome force, a force that is, and it's so, you know, it's the sublime, where you run up against something that is so awe-inspiring, so terrifying, that it is simultaneously obliterating for all of those who come in contact with it. But at the same time, it is awe-inspiring. And I think that that word terrible actually encapsulates that aspect of God.
And then he brings in this crow metaphor. He says, why wouldst thou rude on me thy ring-world right foot rock? Lay a lion limb against me. And here comes the crow. Scan with darksome devouring eyes my bruised bones.
Mm-hmm.
In nature, in the forces of nature, he's seeing God and his own destruction.
Yeah. God is this force that will pick the flesh right off your bones, potentially, will, in order to, for you to feel this full grace, is something that, you know, becomes another obliterating moment.
Me heaped there, me frantic to avoid thee and flee.
And the sense of the self actually trying to escape this awesome power, you know, the ring world right foot rock. I mean, you hear those strong stresses, this very oppressive physical force that keeps him down.
And then he begins the final six lines with why. In other words, why all this suffering? And then he answers, that my chaff may fly, my grain lie sheer and clear. In other words, to be purified by suffering.
Yeah.
But then he says, no. Nay, and all that toil, that coil, sense seems I kiss the rod, hand rather, my heart, lo, lapped strength, stole joy, would laugh, cheer. What do you make of those lines?
It's a classic thing, right? When people ask, why do we suffer? And we are often told, well, it's either God's will or, you know, suffering somehow brings us a kind of purity, a clarity.
Yeah.
And I think he points out that that's not what it is. No, you know, you have to pay fealty, even though it's not fair. You know, no, this is not giving me clarity. Here I am, you know, kissing the rod, subjugating myself to you, Lord. But my heart still laps strength, steals joy, will laugh, cheer. The sense, again, of even in this kind of despair that gives no kind of clarity, it seems also as mysterious why we have joy. Why would we have joy in this moment? Why would we feel like we could have joy? And then he asks, cheer whom, though? The hero whose heaven-handling flung me, foot-trod me, or me that fought him? Do I celebrate God? Do I celebrate these things, or do I celebrate myself?
And his carrion body.
And his parakeet, yeah. Which one? Is it each one?
Yeah.
And so he doesn't actually come up to any kind of conclusion. I think that's why it's such a powerful poem. You know, that there's all this ambivalence.
So let's get to your poem, which...
yeah, which will suffer by comparison, unfortunately. But my crisis of faith is so much less than Gerard Manley Hopkins, because I was raised by atheists and sent to Catholic school. Because they have a very good sense of humor. So my crisis of faith is really a very strange one, which is I grew up surrounded by religious imagery, very attracted to the religious symbolism, the ceremonies, the language, the beauty of the chapels and the churches, but at the same time sort of intellectually trained never to believe what it was that I was reading and seeing and looking at each day in Catholic school, because I would go to Catholic school and I would come back and my dad would say, "What did you learn today?" And I would say, "Oh, you know, the virgin birth." And he would say, "Lies, filthy, filthy lies." So I spent a lot of time reading Gerard Manley Hopkins, and I've always been very struck by his use of syntax, his, you know, sprung rhythms, and his definite language play. And so I wanted to create a poem that was about, I guess, a question of, well, you know, why do I want to believe in something that I'm unable to believe in? And to call very distantly to that Hopkinsian kind of language.
So it's not responding directly to this poem, but to Hopkins' terrible sonnets and his religious dilemma, and more generally, and his language.
Yeah, in a very general way, because what I wanted to do is also fill this poem with malapropisms.
Yes.
So instead of creating all sorts of combined nouns in ways that Hopkins certainly would have done, I play with sort of like these internal sonic jokes, puns, things like that, and malaprops.
Yes. The title is Dear Lacuna, Dear Lard.
Yeah.
Lacuna suggests a missing piece of something, a missing space of text or a silence in music. Mm-hmm. And Dear Lard is self-explanatory, I think.
Yeah, in this case.
You want to give it a read?
Yes. Dear Lacuna, Dear Lard, I'm here. One fat cherry blossom blooming like a clod, one sad groat glazing a needle-puling thread, so what, so sue me. These days, what else to do but leer at any boy with just the right hairline? Hey, I say, that's one tasty piece of nature. Tart darkling, if I could, I'd gin, I'd bargain, I'd take a little troll this moonlit night, let you radish me a while, let you gag and confound me. How much I've struggled with despising you, always, your false poppets, relentless distances. Yet plea bargaining and lack of conversation continue to make me your faithful indefile. I'm lonely. I've turned all rage to rag, all pratfalls fast to fatfalls for you, my farmer in the dwell. So struggle, strife, so strew me to bell with these clucking mediocrities, these anxieties over such beings 30, still smitten with this heaven never meant for, never heard from. You've said we're each pockmarked like a golf course with what can't be said of us, bred in us, isn't our tasty piece of nature. But I tell you, I've stars, I've true blue depths, have learned to use the loo, the crew, the whole slew of pill-popping devices without you, your intelligent and pitiless grays. Everyone knows love is just a euphemism for you've failed me anyway. So screw me. Bartering yam, regardless of want, I'm nothing without scope, hope, nothing without your possibility. So let's laugh, like the thieves we are together, the sieves, you, my Janus gate, my Sigmund fraud, my crawling, crack-crazed street sprawled out, revisible, spellbound. Hello, joy. I'm thirsty. I'm pasty rectum. In your absence, I've learned to fill myself with starts. Here's my paters, here's my blue. I just wanted to write again and say how much I've failed you.
If Hopkins's central tension is whether to believe or not, or whether to succumb to despair, what do you think the central tension here is?
Well, there's a couple of things, which is trying to find that missing piece, right? That bit of text that will sort of slip in and complete the narrative. So I do acknowledge this spiritual presence is absent in my life, and yet clearly is felt. I mean, here I am writing. If he was truly absent, why would I write a letter to this being?
Yeah.
And of course, I end with, "In your absence, I've learned to fill myself with starts." And I think that that's another one of the central tensions in the poem, is without the sort of divine ecstasy that we might be able to engage in if we were true believers, we tend to fill it with all sorts of stuff. We fill it with games. We fill it with entertainment. We fill it with sex. That's why there's erotic references earlier on. We fill it with language. We fill it with, you know, intellectual discourse. We fill it with everything. But what we will actually fill that hole And so, of course, when I say I just wanted to write again and say how much I failed you, there's a play there, because earlier I say I love you is just a euphemism for you failed me. Mm. And so you can sort of switch that around, which is that I failed you is also a euphemism for I love you. So it is a love poem, ultimately. It's mm-hmm. a love poem to one that, if you can't believe, fully exists or can ever really truly respond, is this longed-for absence, this longed-for piece of text that can slip into that absence.
It's a love poem, but it's a highly irreverent love poem. And you're having you're having a great deal of fun with it. And it's saucy throughout. It's taking a struggle seriously, but it's not beyond humor. Hopkins, I would say, is largely beyond humor. I don't think I've ever read anything in Hopkins that made me laugh as I did in your poem.
Oh, well, and I think that's partly because the level of the depth to our questions are completely different. I mean, when Hopkins was a priest. I mean, he was devoted to this idea that God existed and exists for him, and that this is what his entire purpose of his being was, to worship God, to be thinking about those questions. That has not been the issue for me. Mine is, if anything, the postmodern condition, which is, how do we come up with any kind of unifying narrative? And we don't believe in a unifying narrative. We don't believe in, we're trained to be cynical, and we're trained to be ironic about these things. And yet that doesn't entirely negate or erase the desire for the cohesive narrative, the cohesive story that will give us some sense of purpose and meaning. And so I also think, I mean, I think I've been trained since a very young child to not take the spiritual terribly seriously, because it's always been seen through this jaundiced eye, you know, this perspective of, well, this is very unlikely to exist. So I'm not able to engage in the ways that Hopkins had to engage.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to this line, you failed me. Love is just a euphemism for you failed me anyway. Mm-hmm. But I've thought about that since I read that. I've thought about that quite a bit. And it's true, though. It's love often is. When we love somebody, we fail all the people that we love in one way or another, don't we? We can never be everything that we need to be to the people we love.
Yeah. I think that was one of the definite hearts of the poem for me. Like when I got that line, when it came to me as I was writing this poem, it remains true for me still, because we often say we love someone knowing all their faults and all the things that they've done to fail us. We often say we love someone just when they've disappointed us most, to somehow make them feel better.
Yeah.
And this is done to us as well. Like when we are told that we are loved, usually sometimes it's after something terrible has happened to us, or that we've done something not good in the world. Love, we think of as such a wonderful thing, but it's often used to comfort people because they've not been good.
Mm-hmm. And then you end up, and then the next line is, so screw me. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Paisley Rekdal's latest book of poems is called Animal Eye. You can read the poem you just heard and a few others by Paisley on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.